This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You know, an average electrical consumer in Germany gets one rolling blackout every 4 years. An average person in the U.S. has 1.5 per year. So that's six times as many blackouts in the U.S. as in Germany.
Did you lose power at some point this summer? Between the gaps in electricity service, sheltering in place, the fires on the West Coast, and the multiple tropical storms hitting in the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico, people in the U.S. have many reasons to be averting their gaze from the future of our climate. There are, however, a few courageous souls in our institutions of higher learning who persist in imagining what the world will look like a decade or more into the future. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to Daniel Kirk Davidoff, a research scientist at Underwriters Laboratories. He gives us a glimpse into the 2035 climate report from the Center for Environmental Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. There's actually some good news in there. He also sheds light on the complex choices and gambles that result in rolling blackouts across the U.S. While record high temperatures battered the world this summer, not every country's electrical grid responded in the same way.
Who are these children who scheme and run wild? Who speak with their wings in the way that they smile? What are the secrets they trace in the sky? And why do you tremble each time they ride by? Throw out your gold teeth and see how they roll.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Daniel Kirk Davidoff. He is a research scientist at Underwriters Laboratory, that's ULLC, and an adjunct associate professor of atmospheric and oceanic science at University of Maryland. Dan, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. Thanks so much for having me.
Why don't you explain what you do at UL?
Sure. So my job, both here and at my previous employer, for the last 10 years or so, has been predicting solar and wind generation, and in some cases, electrical load for either utilities or ISO, RTOs. These are these organizations that control the balance of the electrical grid over a large area, like the California ISO, or like the New York ISO, or there's another one over Pennsylvania and points west called PJM. These are these large organizations. They're typically nonprofit membership organizations of electrical utilities, but some of them have other structures. But the point is that they are responsible for keeping the balance on the electrical grid over a big area. And they need to know how much electricity is going to be generated on their grid from wind and solar tomorrow, because in many places they operate by holding some kind of an auction for power delivery for each hour tomorrow. And in order to know how much electricity they need to, you know, get assurances of on that auction and how much the electricity they have to put out bids for tomorrow's market, they need to know how much they'll need. And what they'll need is the difference between demand, how much everyone's going to use, and what is going to be generated by solar and wind and in some other technologies. So like nuclear power, they pretty much always run flat out. So you pretty much know you're going to get that much. And then for wind and solar, you're going to get more or less whatever the wind and the sun can deliver, unless you decide to cut back from that amount. What's left after that is the demand that needs to be met by variable power generation, which in most of the country these days is mostly natural gas. So those people who own those natural gas plants are going to make bids to deliver power tomorrow, and whoever bids lowest is going to win.
So why don't we start with this 2035 Berkeley Labs report? It's very optimistic, but I think we could all use a dose of optimism these days.
Absolutely. I think we've been in a national mood of pessimism and worry for quite a while now, but there's a lot going on that's in the energy world that's quite good. So this particular report, this 2035 report put together by Berkeley Lab. You can find it at 2035report.com. It's a look at how we could put together a heavily renewable electrical grid that would have very low carbon emissions across the whole United States. Now, a bunch of people have made efforts to do this kind of thing before, so this is a work in progress. This is a snapshot of what we think a reasonable, but, you know, maybe somewhat optimistic look at how we could go about doing this. You know, what we found over the years is that when you try to project into the future, you know, what will the price of wind power, what will the price of solar power be over the next 10 or 15 years, we've historically overestimated that. So the prices have fallen a lot faster than pretty much anyone, including the most optimistic people, expected that they would, say, 10 or 15 years ago. And there's some danger in assuming that that will go on forever. And I think this 2035 report did a pretty reasonable job of bracketing the range of possibilities from assuming that prices would actually be the same or a little more expensive than they are now, which would be consistent with what the estimates were, you know, five, 10 years ago. Or even less than that, a couple of years ago, versus making an assumption that they'll fall in the same kind of at the same kind of rate that they have in the past, and therefore be quite a bit cheaper going forward.
Yes, let me read from the executive summary on that website. It says, quote, "On the path to 90% over the next 15 years, we can inject $1.7 trillion into the economy, support a net increase of more than 500,000 energy sector jobs each year, and reduce economy-wide emissions by 27%. This future also retires all existing coal plants by 2035, reduces natural gas generation by 70%, and prevents up to 85,000 premature deaths by 2050. Now, when a scientist like yourself reads this, how do you view this report as different than, let's say, a Green New Deal proposal?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what's embodied in this report is quite similar to what's being proposed under the Green New Deal. So, for example, the idea of completely of greening the New York grid to the point of zero. You know, I think the goal is 70% renewables by 2035 and zero carbon emissions by 2050. That's law under the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which was signed about a year ago. And, you know, I think that bill is probably a pretty reasonable template for what kinds of things people have in mind when they propose a federal Green New Deal. So what that means is that besides the targets for greenhouse gas reduction, number one, is that there's also in the bill some pretty explicit call outs to make sure that this, you know, that we're doing justice justly, so that we're, you know, in the process of greening up our grid, we're making a serious attempt to think first of communities that have been at the front lines of damages from the fossil fuel infrastructure over time and maybe have been left out of efforts to create, you know, high-tech jobs in the past. The New York law that I was referring to, the Community Protection, the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, the CLCPA, that law is, I think, a pretty reasonable example of the kinds of things that people would like to do in a national Green New Deal. So, I mean, there's not an employment guarantee, but there are. It's a climate bill that is trying to be very mindful of social justice issues in its carrying out. And this 2035 report also has, you know, its goals in terms of carbon reduction are pretty consistent with Green New Deal type goals nationally.
And in terms of the goals, are they taking reality into account with this? It's very difficult. For example, COVID, that's changing population density in some cities, probably as people start leaving cities.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see like how real that turns out to be. Sure, there's some talk of that. There's definitely some movement of people outside the cities, but I would want to give that a couple of years before I'd speculate about, you know, how much we'll actually see people decamping. Now, on an energy use level, that's actually a really interesting question. We can get into that. The question of like, it is by and large true that people live lower carbon lifestyles when they're in cities, and they certainly And there are certainly a lot of opportunities to have a very high carbon lifestyle when you live in the suburbs. But if the reason they're moving out of the city is not to commute, 50 miles back into the hub, but to sit at home and do most of their work, then that association between higher energy use in the suburbs versus lower in the cities could be weaker. And it's also the case that if you actually look at total personal energy usage between the cities and the suburbs, the fact is that my understanding is that people who live in the cities tend to save money on their use of energy in their homes and in their commutes, with the result that they have money to spare, and so they maybe do more flying on average than people who live further out. So the total amount of energy use, depending on where you live, is not actually that different. What that says to me is that if we want to reduce carbon emissions, we have to make that an explicit goal and have real policies that do that, essentially by replacing technology so that it doesn't matter how much energy you use, none of it is emitting carbon. Once we get into that world, it'll be interesting to see what other constraints exist on our total energy usage. And it'll be interesting to see what our lifestyle choices, what kind of impact our lifestyle choices have on total energy uses. But in terms of carbon policy, if you want people to use less carbon, you got to address that directly.
Walking through the woods the other day, and the world was a carpet laid before me. The birds were bursting and the air smelled sweet and strange. It seemed about 100 years ago. Mary and I, we would sit up on a gate, just gazing at some dragon in the sky, Lord. What tender days we had, no secrets hid away. Well, seem about 100 years ago. Now if you see me drinking bad red wine, don't worry about this man that you loved. Don't you think it's sometimes wise not to grow up?
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Daniel Kirk Davidoff. He's a research scientist at Underwriters Laboratory. So somebody who has solar on their home, solar panels on their mm-hmm. home, versus somebody like me who rents but checks that little box in their utility thing saying, yes, I want green energy, I'm willing to pay a little bit more for it. How does that compare in terms of overall fossil fuel consumption in your estimation?
Right. So the real question is, what's the cheapest way to get one important question anyway, is what is the cheapest way to get electricity without putting CO2 into the air? You know, if you want to hire someone to climb up on your roof and put solar panels up there, that's a way to generate electricity without any carbon emissions. Alternatively, you could put the same number of panels out on a farm field somewhere, and that would be cheaper to install because typically the land under those panels is quite cheap compared to, you know, land in a city. And the labor is less complicated because you don't have to climb up on a roof. You don't have to, you know, worry about the things falling off from the roof onto the street and hurting someone. And you can operate on a much bigger scale. You know, you can just do the same thing over and over and over again over a big area, you know. And so there are some efficiencies of scale. So by and large, it's about 3 times cheaper to get the same amount of electricity from a big solar generating station out on a, you know, out in the desert or out on a farm field than it is to do it on your roof. On the other hand, the roof is just sitting there, so there's nothing bad about putting some money into doing that. And, you know, as I mentioned before, the money is sort of fungible, right? So if you're not spending that money putting solar panels on your roof, the likelihood is you're going to spend that money on something that probably generates more CO2. Like if you decide to forego a vacation in France and instead put solar panels on your roof, you know, there's no question that's a great swap.
And you have more control over your delivery of electricity if it's up on your roof.
I guess, but I really like to encourage people not to think of this as some kind of a badge of, of virtue, like, oh, I get my power from solar power instead of those people who get their power from some dirty source, right? This is a collective problem. The goal is to reduce carbon emissions and basically stop burning gas and coal to make electricity. So how that's going to happen is we're going to create markets. Partially, we're going to generate demand for clean power, and that demand can take the form partially of economic demand in the sense that, you express interest, you're willing to pay, so someone's willing to build a solar farm, that's great. On the other hand, we're going to create a political demand because we're going to go out and vote, and we're going to go out on the streets and say that we really care about this, and then hopefully our government will respond and say that we're going to be developing our power from clean sources as a matter of policy. And, both of those things are important, but exactly how you express that is probably much less important. The main thing is that people who have, power over the electrical system need to be aware that we care, that we, not keep fouling our air with all the bad stuff that comes out of coal and gas plants, CO2 being one of those things, and particulate pollution and sulfur dioxide and all sorts of other bad stuff being some of the other consequences.
Sticking to California, there's some real upheaval here in the state with the wildfires, but we've also seen a return to deliberate rolling blackouts, something that hadn't happened in many years, by the California Independent System Operator here. So first, why don't you just kind of recap what's been going on in terms of these CAISO blackouts?
Yeah, so I'm going to forget the exact dates, but because I wasn't there. I'm out here in New York where the weather's been, kind of hot and steamy this summer, but nothing too disastrous. But over the last couple of weeks out where you are, it's been just ungodly hot over big parts of California and actually quite consequently over the larger region that's covered by what's called the EIM, which is, I'm forgetting the abbreviation, but it's essentially a larger sort of a superstructure electrical grid in which CAISO, but also a bunch of the neighboring grid operators can share resources. So that whole area was really, really hot. And when it gets really, really hot, there's a couple of things that happen. First of all, the transmission gets a little, it's harder to move electricity and power lines because when they get very hot, they sag and you're not allowed to let them sag too much because you don't want to have any risk of starting wildfires. And secondly, there are some of the fossil fuel power plants that don't perform as well when it gets hot because they're heat engines, so they need to, make stuff hot in one place and then use the difference in temperature between the hot place and the cold place, which is, typically the outside air, to generate motion and, turn turbines and make electricity. And if it gets very hot outside, that doesn't function quite as well. Or there may just be mechanical problems that happen when things get hot and expand and, you get in trouble. So there's a little bit of loss of capacity. There's a little bit of loss of transmission capability. And then there was huge electrical demand because everyone wants to have their air conditioners running when it's really hot. And the air conditioners take more electricity to keep a room the same temperature on the inside when it gets hotter and hotter on the outside. So this all came to a head with the result that the CAISO decided that they were, in danger of running out of capacity. So you never want to do that because you don't want to have an uncontrolled blackout. So instead, they would, with a little bit of warning, I think, although I wasn't there, shut off a couple of different, regions on a schedule so that they just, turned off the electricity to that chunk of the electrical grid and so reduced overall demand so that there wasn't, you didn't exceed the capacity of the system. So that's why you impose a rolling blackout, is just to make sure that you don't get, you don't have more demand than the system can provide. Because if that were to happen, then you could get into a situation where the electrical frequency changed and there could be basically mechanical bad consequences for the grid that if you're an electrical grid operator, you really don't want to allow because it could get you in bigger trouble.
So what does this say to you when you see these blackouts? Seeing that California is having to induce these blackouts, is this something that people all over the country should get used to as we see operators switching to a greener mix?
No, I don't think it really has that much to do with a greener mix. It has to do with making decisions about how much capacity you want available on your grid and what risk of a blackout you're willing to accept. So, you know, if let's say we're on a completely green, we have, you know, decided we are only going to have zero carbon power on our grid and we don't want to have blackouts. Well, how would we arrange for that? Well, you could build a heck of a lot more wind capacity in Wyoming. And then, you know, the wind, unlike the sun, the wind doesn't die down at the end of the day. So that's when these blackouts tended to happen, was like just towards the end of the day when the sun is setting, but people are still using a lot of, they're still maybe using some power at work, but then they go home. So they're turning on all their air conditioners and lights at home, and you get a big spike. You get a, you know, high demand maintained from the middle part of the day, but the solar power is coming down. So you need something else to come in and support that. So that's provided by some combination of things that you can, you know, importing power from the hydropower in the Pacific Northwest, or spinning up gas-fired power plants, or bringing in power from Wyoming where there's lots of wind. Well, you know, you could build more wind power in Wyoming. And then the other thing that's very doable, and we haven't come anywhere near close to exhausting the possibility of this, is demand management. So, for example, a lot of utilities in California have these programs where you can sign up and then the utility will pay you. And what they're paying for is the ability to have a finger on your thermostat. So when they're concerned that, you know, demand may get to be excessive, they just turn down everyone's air conditioner, you know, turn up the thermostat effectively for everyone over a big area by a few degrees. No one's power has to go out. Consumption goes down and we're a little bit warmer. Maybe we get a little sweaty, but it's nothing terrible. You're not making people swelter in 90 degree heat in their houses because they're not losing their air conditioner. It's just going down to half capacity. So that's the other thing you can do is have a smart thermostat that is informed by the utility that in this evening is going to be a tough one. So then it says, oh, okay, power is cheap now, but it's going to be expensive later. What do I do? I'm going to turn the temperature in the house way down now to, like, you know, 65 degrees or... And then there's lots more technical possibilities of doing things like that, essentially banking coldness by generating cold water or generating ice during the middle of the day, and then using that coldness to do your air conditioning later on in the day. So there's lots of ways around this. It's just, you know, a capacity we need to build as we're going through this transition to a clean grid.
People are talking.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Daniel Kirk Davidoff. He's a research scientist at Underwriters Laboratory.
So combining the first thing we hit upon with the Berkeley Lab's 2035 report with these CAISO blackouts, what do the blackouts say to you about how we're incorporating renewables onto our collective grids?
I'm not sure they say very much. I think what the blackouts say is more that, you know, we value having low-cost electricity in our country. And, you know, that's okay. We can have an electrical grid with lots of renewables on it that's low-cost because renewables are getting cheap. But if we want to have a completely reliable grid, then we probably have to spend some more. And you can see that by comparison with other countries. So, for example, Germany pays twice as much for electricity as California does. They pay about 30 cents a kilowatt hour, and Californians pay about 16 cents a kilowatt hour. Germany has, you know, an average electrical consumer in Germany gets one rolling blackout every 4 years. An average person in the U.S. has 1.5 per year. So that's six times as many blackouts in the U.S. as in Germany.
I guess it's similar to the way we view our gas. Anytime Americans have a chance to kick the can down the road, they do. And I think that might apply here as well.
Right. But, it's also a set of value decisions about just like how nice we want things to be, right? Because in, where does that money go? I mean, some of it is probably just general funds, but it also may be, being spent on infrastructure and, having roads that are really beautiful and don't have potholes and all that good stuff. So, those are questions that, we can make public decisions about. My personal preference, would be to have that's interesting. I mean, I think I'd be all for having, really nice infrastructure. To me, like avoiding the possibility of having 4 hours a year of rolling blackouts, it's not really worth paying twice as much for electricity. I don't mind having a blackout occasionally.
But is there a direct correlation between the price of one's electricity when you were quoting like the 16 cent per kilowatt and then the amount of rolling blackouts we have?
Oh, sure.
Really?
Oh, absolutely.
So if we wanted to pay 25 cents per kilowatt hour, we would have less blackouts because people would be using less electricity and then the grid would be less stressed. Is that how the calculation would work?
No, I mean, that might be part of it. But the main thing is that we would just spend more money on, more redundant infrastructure. Right. I mean, one of the reasons you have cheap electricity is that you don't have a lot of, I mean, this has been considered a success in many parts of the country. I think ERCOT, the Texas electrical grid, is often held up as a really good example of this, that they run essentially a very efficient free market for electricity, with the result that you don't have a lot of waste of, generation capacity just sitting around not making any electricity. You use what you have efficiently. And that means you don't have to be spending money maintaining equipment that doesn't get used very often. But by and large, all other things being equal, if you make that decision to not have very much spare generation equipment lying around, when on those very rare occasions when you have a big spike in demand because it's a once in 10 years heat wave over a broad area, then you don't have it lying around and you can't meet the demand. So you have to have rolling blackouts. So it's a purely, a pure decision of do we care enough about avoiding those to spend the money to not do it. The other thing you can do is have more redundant transmission capability. So if it gets so hot that power lines are sagging and you can't import electricity on those lines, well, you have more lines. So you don't need to move as much electricity on a single set of lines.
So would it be fair to say that these redundant systems, like in Germany, are better capable of weathering significant climate events that we're seeing this year in the U.S. And I don't think this is a 1 in 10 year type of heat wave we're seeing, right? Every year it's the hottest year on record. So we're seeing more and more of these type of once in a lifetime events, whether it be double hurricanes in the Gulf and terrible wildfires in California. It seems like there's some real value to having that kind of redundancy rather than having a razor thin margin of error.
Yep, absolutely. But, there's a cost to it one way or another.
Well, I always appreciate the insight. Daniel Kirk Davidoff, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're so welcome, Alex. It was great to be here.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Steely Dan, The Rolling Stones, and Gillian Welch.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.